And you are listening to Pacific Underground on KBOO.FM online and 90.7 on the dial. We are live this morning, and we have sort of a hybrid show for you all. Some of it's going to be a live interview. We're going to be talking about the Oppression Olympics, the Olympics that you've never heard about, but partake in.
Been part of, yeah.
And also, we're going to be talking, well, we're going to be listening to me talking to author of newly released novel White Tears, Hari Kunzru. So, Jenna, how do we want to start this off?
Well, I guess let's talk a little bit about, like, what is Oppression Olympics? there we go, some live radio, some afternoon phlegm there getting going. Yeah, it's
welcome transitional
to,
phlegm.
Yeah, welcome to live radio. That's how much Oppression Olympics just makes me go like, but, you know, so we're going to have Scott Nakagawa, who's about to run into the studio here. So while we're waiting for him, talking about what kind of inspired us to have Scott on. So if you've listened to our show before, we've interviewed Scott a couple times. And Scott is an amazing activist and writer. He's associated with the grassroots political lab called Change Lab. Oh, there's Scott. Welcome to the studio. And Change Lab, and here, I have the exact description from their website, and I really like. Change Lab is a grassroots political lab that explores how U.S. demographic change is affecting racial justice politics with the strategic focus on Asian American identity. So, welcome to the studio, Scott.
Thank you for having me.
He's getting all situated here. So, you know, Scott, the reason we asked you in to come in because, one, you're incredibly I don't know. You just got pearls of wisdom. You just got pearls of wisdom that you put out on Facebook. And that's what it started us to call you. Like, Scott, you need to come in. Because you do these amazing Facebook posts. If you're one of Scott's 3,000 Facebook friends, and maybe you've read it. But you recently posted one where you mentioned about Oppression Olympics. And here, I'll read a little bit of your post. This is a little clip from it here. On April 13th, you wrote, like, less damaging, but also not in our interest, is making the case that the categories are not natural, but suggesting that they were synthesized, meaning all these groups of oppression that we have, that they are synthesized mainly in service of hate and not in order to serve capital. By leaning on hate, we turn a systemic form of oppression into a matter of individual prejudice. This, in turn, makes the case for liberal individualism one of the nuts of racial oppression, especially in the post-civil rights era. We also, and this could easily grow into laundry lists, believe me, invite hierarchies of oppression, kind of an Oppression Olympics of sorts. Why don't you give us your definition of Oppression Olympics? This is a term that I think many activists are used to hearing, but I feel like the definition gets manipulated for people's purposes.
And I have to confess that I had never heard or used that term before I saw that post.
It's one of those terms that make me cringe when I say it.
Yes, this might be a generational thing, but boy, did we talk about the Oppression Olympics all the way through the 90s and the early 2000s. The Oppression Olympics is kind of a term that's used to refer to the way that people compete with each other around oppression. So we basically claim legitimacy on the basis of having suffered oppression and then rank oppressions based upon how badly we feel we have suffered. And on the basis of how badly we have suffered, we give ourselves sort of virtue points, right? So the more you've suffered, the more legitimate you are, putting you in a position to be able to define what the issues are for whatever group you're in. So that, to me, is the Oppression Olympics.
Well, and something else that I think of when I think of that term, Oppression Olympics, as you're saying that it helps to legitimize, and then the flip side of that is that you're delegitimizing other people, and that's what drives me nuts. It's, you know, it's to me, it's fine if, and we need this, we need people to talk about what are their oppressions, and we need people to talk about their personal experiences so we understand how people's daily lives are being led through these oppressions. But then when they use that as a, well, you don't know oppression, you don't have these grievances because I have these grievances. It's as someone who has traveled in and out of various activist circles, it becomes maddening because it's just an argument you cannot win.
Well, you know, what happens with me a lot is that people will say to me, well, if I were a model minority, I might see it that way, but I'm not. I suffer in a different way, right? As a way of arguing over a political point, a difference in political opinion, right? That is should be debated. And if my opinions are, you know, viewed by someone as wrong, they should actually challenge them, I think. You know, the reason why I put them out in the way I do is in order to invite challenge, to be part of a critical dialogue where people could tell me that's just BS. I don't care. You know, I mean, I want to hear that, right? If that's what you believe. But I don't want the basis for your argument with me to be, I've suffered more than you, and therefore my perspective is more accurate or a more accurate reflection of the problem that is being faced, right? Mm-hmm. That's what I don't want, because it then essentializes our opinions in our identities. And essentialism is one of the bases of racism.
Yeah, what do you mean by essentialism for people who don't really use that word in their vernacular?
Sure. Well, in the racial system, essentialism basically says that there are certain essential characteristics that are rooted in us based upon our racial categorization, right? How we're categorized racially. And so if you're a person of color, you have certain kind of views that are essentially yours as a person of color, or you may have particular characteristics like being prone to criminality or being a model minority, for example.
I think one thing that I hear from people who like to defend this idea of the oppression Olympics, not that I hear many people defending that idea directly, but they, or at least within that terminology, is that people, I think, are sometimes they engage in this type of argument about who is the more oppressed, because I think they're worried about their oppressions not being centered when they're the ones at the center of it. And I think it gets confused and people worried about being delegitimized in a way.
Yes, I do think that's true. I also think it's a way that we depoliticize racial politics, right, by personalizing it. We take this idea that feminism gave us, a great idea, that the personal is political, and turn it on its head and make everything political, personal, right? In order for us to have a real discussion about race and power and how race actually causes stratification of power and anti-democracy, we need to get away from all of that, right? That doesn't mean that our personal experiences don't matter, and it doesn't mean that it isn't important for us to understand how our experiences inform how we understand the world, right? That's actually critically important. We always have to be aware of both our biases and our gifts, right? But to make that the premise for a political strategy doesn't make any sense to me.
You know, we're going to move over to our interview with Hari Kundru. But we want to give out the phone number for people to call in, because after the interview, we're going to come back with Scott Nakagawa. And we're going to talk about, well, okay, so what do we do? What do we do, and how do we center people? And how do we not all fall into the trap of the oppression Olympics, which is what ultimately, you know, white supremacy would love us to do, because it helps that wedge. So we're going to get some advice from Scott. What is our call number? It's 503-231-SAM. He's got it.
503-231-8187.
Okay, 503-231-8187. We encourage people to call in with your questions or comments. We have guest Scott Nakagawa. In the meantime, you're listening to Pacific Underground here on KBOO Radio. And Kanan, why don't you tell us what we got coming up next?
Yeah, I spoke to an author, Hari Kundru. He's British. He's he's mixed race and he's from England, but he's living on the East Coast now as an author. This is he just published his fifth novel. It's called White Tears. And it kind of blew my mind, because it wove together like this like deeply psychological narrative of this really privileged white character. And it connected it to the historical oppression of black people in the South, and how their culture was essentially stolen from them by the advent of recorded music and 78 RPM discs. So, yeah, I think the story kind of like speaks for itself. So, without further ado, we'll go to that. earlier this month, British author and journalist Hari Kunzuru published his fifth novel, titled White Tears. I don't quite know how to categorize it, so I'll set the scene real quick. When I first cracked White Tears open, and well into the first few chapters of the book, I expected to be taken deep into the main character's psyche and experience his white guilt and fragility in a first-person fictional narrative, essentially what the title suggests. And ultimately, that's what I experienced, only not at all in the way that I had anticipated. The book's central character, Seth, is a white college graduate and self-described social outcast. He has a lot of neuroses, and his headiness often gets in the way of him making any meaningful social connections in school. That is, until he meets Carter Wallace. Carter and Seth share a common fanaticism about old and rare music, particularly black music produced in the early 20th century. Carter's trust fund family legacy enables Seth to experience secondhand his rich friend's complete obsession with old 78 RPM discs from blues musicians in the early 1900s. Carter is fixated on this idea of authenticity and wants to make a name for himself and, to a large extent, live up to his family's lofty statusy expectations of him. I don't want to do too much talking before we get into the interview, and I also don't want to give any spoilers away, but the boys end up taking a field recording that Seth one day captures when he's out walking in the park and encounters a black chess player singing a blues refrain. They take that and they add authentic sounding crackles and hisses and a finger-picking guitar track underneath to create a compelling and completely fraudulent item that they post online to gain notoriety and earn some of the envy of some hardcore pre-war blues record collectors. They name their creation Charlie Shaw's Graveyard Blues. Seth and Carter soon find their lives completely hijacked by this creation, and a mysterious record collector insists that Charlie Shaw and Graveyard Blues are actually real, and a sort of haunting begins. I spoke recently with Hari over the phone about his new novel, White Tears, and we talked about structural and unresolved historical racial trauma and his inspiration behind writing the novel. Before we got into any of that, though, I wanted to know about his own interest in music, because as an author, it was clear that he had some sort of deep appreciation of music and the history of music in the American South. We'll drive out into the country far from the city and watch the pretty lights a-twinkling off and on. A pretty baby, a pretty baby, but won't you come and go along? Has writing this book changed your relationship to music, specifically black music?
I don't think so. I mean, it gave me an excuse to listen to a great deal of early 20s and 30s music. But I've always kind of had a very I don't know. I'm always digging up different kinds of things to listen to. I was listening to a lot of prog rock today for some reason while I'm trying to write a piece of journalism about Trump's 100 days pomposity drama. Sorry, I've gone horribly off topic there.
No, I like the tangents. Wait, what prog rock were you listening to?
I was listening to this Vangelis and Demis Roussos used to have a band called Aphrodite's Child, and they did a concept album about the Book of Revelation, and it's completely insane. It's a huge towering production, and Demis Roussos singing in a very strong Greek accent about the four horsemen of the apocalypse.
Horses
kind of brilliant and absurd.
Wow. So you do you identify as kind of like a music collector or a music nerd?
Sure. I mean, I have no particular status in any of these worlds. I'm definitely a fan, but I mean, there's always somebody who knows who played congas on the B side.
And yeah, in a way, like how do you even engage? There's like this such a dissonance to like engaging in those communities where there is a lot of status and the social capital is all wrapped up in like who owns what. And that's so central to kind of the darkness underlying a lot of this book. It'd be super surprising and like fascinating if you were like deeply immersed in the blues collecting community.
No, I'm a tourist in that world. I kind of, you know, I sort of love record collectors for their single-mindedness and their obsession. But there is a darkness to it, especially with the people who are collecting 78s, because there's a, you know, very often the person, if you may have the only copy of something, or you may basically be in a position to, you know, to allow people to master from it or whatever. Because there's no, you know, some of the most famous music is blues music, is that, you know, really doesn't exist in very many copies at all. So if you have the least crackly copy of a Tommy Johnson record or a Charlie Patton record, then, you know, people have to come to you. And there are very few people who are in that world. It is a tiny subculture, and they often seem to know who has what records and are scheming and plotting to try and, you know, work out how they could get a particular thing that they desire above all others. Like, what would they give away? So there's skullduggery and craziness of all kinds.
Where do you like to start when you talk about your book? I mean, it's called White Tears, and for me that conjured up an image of it being somewhat about like white fragility and kind of like a modern sense, but it really goes much deeper than that. It goes like deep into the roots of post-bellum South and the exploitation and erasure really of black bodies, and how that is going on today in this like neo-colonial kind of way. So where did that title come from, I guess? Because I don't think that's at all a phrase that's in the book.
No, it's not. And it is, as you say, is a kind of, it's a provocative phrase that turns up in internet arguments about white fragility. And it was a way of signing that, although this is a novel which is very concerned with the past and with the historical foundations for situations that pertain now, that it is, I want people to read it through the current situation, you know, where we are now with all this. You know, it's, I mean, it was a book with various starting points. I mean, one of which was what happened, well, the atmosphere, maybe I should say, when I moved to the U.S. back in 2008 to come and live. You know, before that, I was living in London. That's where I was brought up. And I arrived in time for the election campaign that brought Barack Obama to power. And I was very struck by, after his victory, how quick commentators were to declare that we were entering a post-racial era. There was an indecency to the haste with which they wanted to declare that the past was finished and they could draw a line under it. And that really got me thinking about how toxic America's history has, America's racial history in particular, has been for social and political relations today. And I mean, the way my mind works is very often to head back in the past and to try and see how things have emerged in a historical way. So I did find myself reading a lot about the origins of, you know, what we've now, you know, after Michelle Alexander, tend to term the new Jim Crow, the sort of prison and just, you know, justice system pipeline that leads a disproportionate number of African Americans into prison. What was increasingly clear to me was that there was a real historical continuity, that practices that had emerged in slavery and especially in the years after slavery, when people were searching for new ways of controlling the black population in the South, these practices were kind of, you could draw a straight line between them and what was going on right now in places like Ferguson.
Yeah, you did a really amazing job. What's one thing that's striking about the book is that the point of departure is from this relationship between these two white college age students, and it just gets woven into it, kind of collides with this period that you're talking about and the new Jim Crow, and it kind of ties that historical background into this kind of other universe that seems entirely separate at first.
Very important to me to connect those two things. I mean, because I think very often there's a kind of elite hipster culture that sees itself as rather exempt from this history, and it doesn't see any connection between living, you know, in a loft in a city like New York or Portland, and the social relations more generally in the country. And I'm also interested in the way that culture works in all of this, and of course the long and sad history of cultural appropriation of especially black music. So I mean that music has an interesting role in all of this, because it's so sort of such a sort of powerful cultural force now, and you know, and music is one of the ways by which black culture gets brought to the forefront in the debate in the U.S., but also it has this history, and it was a way of tying a couple of young white guys who would consider themselves social liberals and pretty, you know, decent guys who kind of love black music into this larger history.
So there's a lot of darkness in this book. I mean, things don't necessarily like turn out well for the main characters that you kind of follow. And you don't necessarily follow one person throughout, and it's kind of discontinuous. And I really enjoyed that. I don't think I've like experienced that in a novel before quite in the way that you've done it. But there really isn't this point where the characters from whose point of view the book is written, Seth, comes to some sort of understanding of his own complicitness in this whole process of exploitation and appropriation. So where does this darkness in the story come from?
Because I think a redemptive narrative would be false right now. I mean, we've had no redemption from this. And it's not something that's concluded and should be tied up with a bow and allowed to drift away. I wanted to make a story that really stayed in that ambiguous, uncanny, uneasy place, which is where I think we find ourselves with all this now. I mean, this is, you know, none of this stuff is over, and you know, I mean, as it turns out, America's decided to elect Trump as the president, and we have more or less overt white nationalists in the White House, and further away than ever from any kind of realization. So the other thing I'd say about it is that, you know, you say that the central character doesn't really have a moment of, you know, cathartic recognition of his own complicity or whatever. In some sort of basic way, I just don't think it is about personal guilt. It's about systems, and it's about changing those systems rather than for any individual trying to kind of worm their way out from some sort of burden of historical guilt. It's about structures, it's about following the money, it's about understanding how systems of power that are much bigger than individuals and have nothing to do with individual guilt or otherwise, you know, function to entrench white privilege in this country.
Yeah, and you sketched out the structure in a really compelling way by kind of framing this friend of the narrator, Seth, Carter Wallace, and his family, and the legacy that goes back. And it's really dark because they essentially ran
a
labor camp, almost like the successor to chain gangs. Yeah, well, like that,
yeah,
where did that idea come from?
Question. I mean, it's you know, the old line in the gospel song about when do we get paid for the work we've done, and that, you know, that contains the deep truth of this whole thing in it, in that it is about whose labor built these great fortunes that do now exist in this country. This is a time of enormous wealth and a very uneven distribution of that wealth. We're back to the social relations of the Gilded Age before the First World War. And so whose labor made that, and who and what kind of compensation should be made? The whole question of reparations is very fraught, if only because of practical considerations. I think the moral case is clear, but the practical method of conducting it is not. That's one, one way I think the novels can work really well in addressing these questions, because you can go to all sorts of different levels. You can kind of come out and look at great swathes of time and see how things have emerged, and then you can go right into the psychology of individual characters. And I like to write and read things that connect those two registers.
Speaking to kind of like going deep into the psyches of these characters, I was really struck by how this one passage, two-thirds of the way through the book, really kind of enshrined that from like a kind of oblivious, privileged white person perspective. And it's the passage where there's kind of this confrontation after this huge search for this kind of mysterious character of Charles Shaw, who we're not really sure the entire time if he's a real musician or not. It seems like the main character sort of made him up to as like a profit scheme or like some sort of scheme to gain notoriety in like the audiophile rare music collecting community. But they confront this modern incarnation of what was originally black blues music. And so the passage goes, "Inside the car, the passenger laughs. He hangs an arm out of the door, an arm like a twist of black wire, ending in a gold-ringed hand holding a big gulp cup of purple soda. I am cowed by these men, conscious of my meager white body." So as someone who is not white, how did you go about getting into the psyche of a kind of fragile white college boy hipster?
I'm very familiar with it. While I'm not white, I'm also not black as well. And I've, my initial relationship to black culture and black American culture in particular was through music. I grew up in a very white suburb of London, and it's quite strange that it was a very racist place back in the 80s. There was a lot of the far right skinhead groups around and so on, but there was also a real tradition of caring about soul music, and so all the records that I was hearing and the records that I was buying as quite a young kid, like 11, 12 year old kid, were soul records and jazz funk records and early hip hop records, and this is all going on. I mean, the people who were listening to this music and enjoying it were at the same time expressing incredibly racist opinions about black and Asian people. And this is a kind of paradox of my teenage life. I was very unhappy there and couldn't wait to leave. And what eventually, where the way I did leave was to go to university, to go to Oxford University, where I fell amongst a bunch of very sort of elite young white men who had a big reggae listening habit with all the kind of complexities that involves, these sort of public school, private school, I suppose he's a private school, boys with blonde dreadlocks and red, gold, and green clothing.
Classic.
That was something completely different, and I was highly exoticized as an Asian for being, although I was actually a sort of suburban boy. I had to come to terms with what it meant, to be so, and I was sort of in love with this, a lot of this music that has been part of my life all my life, and yet I was going through a milieu where people who made the music were not present. They were, in fact, almost excluded from these places. I mean, there were very, very few black students at Oxford when I was there. And so, a lot of this kind of world that Seth and Carter come from in the book is drawn very closely from experience and is you know, their kind of, I call it at one point, it's a professorial knowledge of the music is kind of overcompensating for the fact that they know that they don't have an organic connection to it.
Right.
You know, and also I'm interested in the fact that that if you want to say something is great art, and I think a lot of this music is extraordinary, and the blues, you could make a case that the blues is one of the great American artistic achievements, and great art has to be able to speak outside its original context. And even, you know, if you want to say that the African and American originators of blues or jazz have some sort of priority, their work has to also be able to speak to people who aren't black. And what does that mean? You know, what does it mean when you love something but you don't own it? And that's an interesting question to me, because it's a question I had to face with my own relationship with all this music. And, you know, it's something that has to be recognized, that, you know, it is okay to love it, but, you know, it's not okay to try and control it, or, you know, less still to profit from it. So there are ambiguities there, and there are sort of parts of the story that don't boil down to evil white people ripping off creative black people.
Talk about the significance of the entrance of, I guess, the supernatural towards the end. It was shocking to me, and really, I guess the shock added to the compellingness in this case, I think it was really effective, of this story that kind of follows this narrative. It gets kind of like gruesome, and there are deaths, and there are injuries, and it's kind of a fraught narrative for these characters. And then there's this supernatural part at the end that almost turns it into like a revenge ghost story. What's the significance of that, and where'd that idea come from?
Well, very early on, I knew I wanted to write a ghost story, and I wanted to kind of honor the conventions of the ghost story as well, because that it seemed like the appropriate form to try and talk about this in. I mean, ghost stories are always about something in the past that has been prematurely buried or repressed or prematurely forgotten, and that forces its way up into the present and makes itself felt. And, you know, and I think there's very often a kind of political dimension to this. I mean, if you know, it intrigues me how many American ghost stories are set on the site of an old Indian burial ground. You know, that right. What, you know, the primary kind of repression, you know, social repression is this feeling that the country was built on the back of this genocide that hasn't been acknowledged or paid for. And so, you know, what would be haunting us? But because the people we killed to get the country, and I think that's true of slavery as well, and it's doubly true of what happened after slavery. I mean, I think this is a willful forgetting of the injustices of the Reconstruction period and of the Jim Crow South right up to the present day. I mean, it's not like things were done with the passing of the Civil Rights Act in 1964. It's a every step of the way, it's been a very, very hard fought process, and so, you know, a ghost story seems to me the appropriate way to approach this whole story, about because it is about repression and forgetting and memories kind of forcing themselves back. And, you know, also there is a revenge element that is there, and I think it was probably easier for me to do it as somebody who's kind of stumbling in from outside. You know, and fooling around with stuff he had no business in, rather than a black American writer, or indeed a white American writer, both of whom I think would find it difficult to occupy that particular space.
Can you talk about the revenge at the end of the story that happens? I was left after completing the book feeling like kind of like, I don't know, dirty or something, because there's just like a bloodbath at the end. Where was the inspiration behind tying up the book in that way?
I suppose this is all sort of heading into the territory of spoilers, isn't it?
I suppose it is, yeah. Maybe talk as vaguely as you
feel
necessary.
I'm trying to find a way of talking about it, but I mean, I think there are acts of violence in the book that are at the same time sort of off stage, but a kind of very central to how it does tie itself up. And it's also, it makes the central character into a kind of instrument of other forces. I mean, I think there's one way of reading the book is that he is unstable, and that this whole story about history is a way of him justifying some impulse to violence that he has. And there's another kind of way of reading the book, a more supernatural way, that suggests that a kind of historical revenge is being enacted through him, that he's the plaything of these historical forces. And I like to kind of keep both of those plates spinning, I suppose. Mm-hmm.
Well, thank you, Hari Kunzer, for your time. Hope we get to talk again sometime.
I hope so, too. Thanks very much.
Take care.
Bye now.
That's 503-231-8187. That's the number to call if you want to get in on this conversation. If you're just joining us, this is Pacific Underground. We are live in studio. We just listened to a little pre-recorded segment. It actually wasn't that little. I hope you enjoyed that. We're returning to our conversation with Scott Nakagawa, and we want to kind of pose a question for listeners to kind of join in around, and maybe we'll be talking about it all the while people have a chance to call in. And so I wanted to bring the conversation to, like, where should our point of departure be when we're talking about trying to steer the conversation away from, like, comparing one set of oppressions to another? Like, how do we acknowledge that all of us are going through our own processes of addressing our own problematic stuff within us? And how do we not shut each other down? And how do we stop placing the blame on the individual and instead talk about the structure that the individual is channeling, the structure of oppression, or the problematic nature of the society that we live in that the individual is channeling and embodying in that moment, whether they are aware of it or not. So again, if you want to comment on anything around that, give us a call, 503-231-8187. Does anyone want to go about addressing that?
That's such an easy question to answer there, Kanan. Just, okay, how do we just address, okay, let's just get rid of the oppression Olympics that has been such a active part of creating more oppressions in this country. Scott and I were talking a little bit before the show actually came on, and something interesting he was talking about was this concept of innocence, how we gravitate towards that. Scott, could you speak a little bit about that?
I think that, you know, we've talked a lot, I think, about white innocence, not we here in the studio, but generally speaking within the progressive community as being a kind of a lever of violence against people of color. But, you know, innocence is a kind of a thing in the United States, right? It is a lever of, Indian removal, what we called Indian removal. It was a way of containing white women and keeping them excluded from the workforce. It's worked in so many different ways in our culture that we think of innocence as a virtue, and we position ourselves as innocent when we call other people out for their sins, right? Mm-hmm. But, innocence is BS. None of us are innocent. And so speaking to Kanan's point, we all have internalized racism. To not admit that is to trivialize the power of race and racism in defining the realities that we live in within this culture, right? So an example of that is how, people often think of race as a biological thing, right? They think, for example, African Americans are more naturally athletic. Well, African people are not more naturally athletic, but a particular group of people from a particular part of Africa may be more prone to having greater bone density, higher muscle mass, and may perform well in particular sports, right? What was that?
Oh, we have a caller. Pam, are you there?
Yes,
North
I
Portland?
Am. I sure am. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us.
Hi, Pam.
Hello. I just wanted to let you know that that interview you did was fabulous. And in answer to your question, of course, no answer is a complete answer. But in my own experience, I've been working within a small group of people, women basically, for the last couple of years. And the more we talk about our individual troubles, the more we see that we are truly related, even though, you know, we have way different backgrounds and we're from different families and everything. So I just wanted to note that. Thank you. Okay.
Thank you, Pam. I appreciate
Bye-bye.
The input.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thanks, Pam. So the where I was headed is, you know, we think of these things as being racial when they have nothing to do with race, right? Mm-hmm. Race is a political construct, and white supremacy is a comparative system, right? White supremacy is the form of capitalism that is rooted in the United States. And so when we compare one another by race, say one group is more oppressed than another, we risk making the categories within that hierarchy seem natural and even biological, when in fact they're politically constructed, right? So we would do better to think about groups as related to one another than as compared to one another, right? That kind of comparative way of seeing things encourages the oppression Olympics. If we think of ourselves as related to one another and that our experiences each build upon each other, we might do better at figuring out how to work together.
Hmm. I think we got another caller on the line. Who was it?
Bradley in Southeast.
Bradley in Southeast. Are you there, Bradley?
Hi.
Hey, Bradley. Thank you for calling into our show. What questions do you have?
What's on your mind?
Well, I mean, it's very, it's a subject that requires very mature people who can handle some hard truths about themselves and about others, and who could actually displace any type of personal feelings and really try to listen. These type of subjects require good listeners. Like what one of the people on your show just said, that it's political. And I'll take it one step further, and I'll say that the political side of racism in this country revolves around economics. And if we're going to talk about politics and race, we might as well take it one step further and talk about the economics that the political is directly connected to. Now, when we look into that, that's when we're able to separate the boys from the men and the girls from the women. Because we're talking about something that is about as synonymous as what the Jews went through in Nazi Germany. All right, it's just that everything was done in a very quiet way. Now, where am I going with the economic side?
That's what I want to know.
We're talking about inherited wealth in this country. And there are people who were systematically, even up to this day, concerning redlining, concerning prison industrial complex, with people doing exorbitant time in the prison system for doing what others can do in Oregon and Washington and Denver completely legally. You know, we're talking about a displacement of an entire generation and how complicated it could be for the younger generation, and how deeper they're going to have to delve into fixing this, because you're right, this thing is bigger than just one person. This is something that we all have to try to fix and go a little bit beyond words.
So how do you think,
I know,
can I interject real quick? How do you think we apply that sort of like structural understanding to conversations with our community members? Like in your mind, how does that happen without shutting down conversation?
Well, like I said, it requires mature people. It's kind of like...
And what makes a mature person?
Excuse me?
What makes a mature person?
That's a different subject. That's a different subject, because a mature person can have an adult conversation and understand that it's not personal. A mature person will understand, I realize this person isn't comparing their struggles to mine. It's not a personal thing. You know, it's almost like an invalidation thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, if I'm having this very mature conversation with somebody, I have to be emotionally stable myself.
Right.
Because if they say something that I don't like, I'm going to immediately focus in on myself instead of actually listening.
Yeah, I want to give our guests a chance to respond here. Scott, do you have any thoughts?
Well, I'm not sure what I think about the maturity part of this, but I do think that the kind of ranking that we do is based on a really bad analysis of race, right? I think it's important to remember, as our caller reminded us, right, that white supremacy was and is an economic system justified socially and enforced politically, right? And so white supremacy is a system of social stratification and economic exploitation. In order to undo it, right, we need to think about power. What we do in this kind of ranking has nothing to do with building the kind of power we need in order to be able to topple white supremacy, right? It may feel empowering, but that experience of empowerment, if we get stuck there, is what we're trading for real power.
We got another caller on the line there. Thank you for calling in, Bradley. We got Sean on the line. Actually, before we bring Sean real quick, I'm wondering, Scott, on the practical level, you know, we're talking about, yes, we need to stop being so comparative and, you know, we need to move relationally. What does that look like to you on a practical sense, on a day-to-day basis for people who are trying to engage in these discussions with themselves and, you know, in the workplace, that sort of thing? How does this practically work out? And just, you know, online, that's where people are having discussions.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I mean, I think that it's important to depersonalize it. And I understand that's difficult. When I was a younger person, not that youth has anything to do with it, but let's just say, you know, I used to be different. you know, I would call you out in a minute. You know, I just, it felt really cathartic to do it,
mm-hmm.
because it's naming a problem and giving it a face so that you can hang on to that thing and, you know, kind of objectify it and understand it and your place within it. You know, it feels less denigrating if you can say to somebody who says something insensitive that that's BS, right? And to describe for them and describe in the course of it to yourself what the problem is. But when we depersonalize it to some, at least to a degree, it helps us to see that racism is actually a structural problem of society, right? It is a way that power is leveraged so that wealth and, you know, political influence go up, right?
Mm-hmm.
They trickle up because of racism. Racism is a form of anti-democracy. Sexism is as well. Right, we should think of sexism and sexual assault as structural problems of society, as impediments to democracy. So if we want real democracy, a context in which, you know, a plural democracy, a context in which we can debate these issues and actually talk about real solutions and not just get caught talking about tropes and stereotypes, we need to start to think of these things as structural problems and not just interpersonal problems. And when we think of it as an interpersonal problem, we reduce race to simple prejudice, and we lose the thread of what we need to be doing in order to address it and defeat it.
Mm-hmm.
Do we still have our caller on the line there, Sean?
Hi.
Hey, Sean.
Hi. You might not agree with this, but whenever I hear identity politics, I just immediately think of the counterintelligence programs of the 60s and 70s, the dirty tricks pulled by the FBI and COINTELPRO. So I just immediately assume that it's not incompetence at work, it's treachery. Because people just have to be too stupid to get away from identity politics and move to class. It's so obvious that they're changing the subject from economic exploitation and class division to identity politics, it must be treachery. It can't. People can't be that stupid. Thanks.
Thanks, Sean. Any response to that?
Well, you know, I certainly disagree with the idea that identity politics is just a distraction, right? We all live in identities, right? We all have identities. All politics is identity politics, right? White people, for example, have identities, and they are manifested within our politics. And, you know, the way in which white identity politics has worked historically has, you know, caused the suppression of people of color and other groups. You know, I think that we think of identity politics in this really kind of trivialized way as you hurt my feelings and therefore I'm going to fight you. Right. The reality is that, you know, on the basis of identity, people have been enslaved. Genocides have been committed, right? Racial cleansing campaigns, regimes have been put in place. All of these things are justified on the basis of identity, on the basis of the superior, presumed superior identity. So, you know, identity politics activists basically were being beat up and decided to fight back. The left was rejecting us in that period of time when we started to fight back. And so we had no place else to go but to build our own movements. And so the politics of those movements may not reflect some of the understandings of our, you know, kind of economic reality of the left. But I think to put that at the feet of people who are identity activists is ahistorical. It's just like straight out not an understanding of historically how these movements developed.
Well, and then something that, you know, kind of connecting back to what you were saying is that, you know, that identity politics, you know, by engaging in that, we're actually not so much personalizing it. That's what certain people like to look at it as. But it's actually about taking away from the personal and addressing the structural.
Yes.
And so, I find that interesting connection there.
Well, in speaking to the structural, sorry, Tim, but I will be done shortly. You know, I think we need to recognize that, you know, there's this kind of theory, right, that the primary sort of relationship that we need to be concerned about is between workers and capital, right? So class, therefore, is the primary concern of the left, class in economic terms. But that's just a theory, right? We have to put reality first. In reality, capitalism manifests itself in different places in many different ways. In the United States, it manifests itself in the system of white supremacy, right? That system, thinking historically, has a legacy in the form of structural racism and in a culture of racism that we live in, right? So actually addressing that problem is critically important. Movements against capitalism that are not pro-democratic, that are not pro-democracy movements, are dangerous. We only need to look at Mao and Stalin and, you know, we could go on, right?
Yep.
To see why that is really, really important to us. So in order to actually be a pro-democracy movement in the context of a racial state like the United States, we need to actually be able to deal with the issue of race as a significant problem and as completely intertwined with class. In fact, what class in the United States is in part made of, right? So, you know, class categories include the Asian American model minority, right? The perfectly exploitable worker and the white working class. Another trope, a completely made-up thing, something that originates right in the period around the end of the Civil War when white people finally are starting to coalesce as a working as workers, right? Not just as owners, even if dirt poor owners, right? And Asian workers are being imported into the United States to replace slaves. In that context, the idea of a white working class that is xenophobic and racist is a trope that develops.
Mm-hmm.
But there has never been a pure white working class in the United States. Just witness Trump's visit to the Carrier, you know, plant, right?
Yeah.
Who did you see? A racially diverse group of people. Do you imagine that those people spend their days calling racial epithets to each other as they work next to each other assembling air conditioners? No, this is a multiracial group of people. Workers in the United States come from every race.
Well, we're almost ready out of time, so let's try to get Tim on the air. Tim, are you still there?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Jim in Salem.
I was eating my lunch. I was waiting.
So we got just a couple minutes left here. So what are your thoughts, Tim?
Well, first of all, in my life, I've had the opportunity to work in South and Central America and travel a lot of North America. And I'm kind of mixed. My DNA is mostly white, but I have some Native American, too. And I've noticed that racism in North America, I can see why people are always talking about whites as the racist. But racism is not limited to white people by any means at all. All over South and Central America, I've seen Latinos really extremely racist attitudes towards black people and towards Native American people.
Okay, I'm just going to chime in here real quick and say that, well, we're going to be focusing in on, and what we're focusing on this conversation right now is about systems and structures here in the United States. And, oh man, Tim, you're bringing up just a conversation that we could have a whole other show about. You've said so much there. So we're just going to move on from this conversation because there's too many things to unpack. And we only got a couple minutes left here. So, Scott, I'm going to give you this last couple minutes here to, can we put it to you to, I don't know, answer Kanan's great question, but because like what I'm kind of gathering from here in our last minute is that, like, you know, we need to, in order to be overcome these oppression Olympics and these conversations that are dominating, it is a combination of people, one, identifying how to stop thinking comparatively, but then also needing to learn how to open up the conversation and being okay with people just expressing themselves without it becoming a comparative thing.
Well, yeah, that was a lot.
There you go.
But, you know, I just think we need to think politically, right? So the last caller talked about, you know, prejudice, right, which all of us harbor. That is absolutely true. Racism and race, this is a political system we're talking about, right? It's a structural reality that we live with. And in order to address it, we need to recognize the role that individual prejudice plays in, you know, in that system as a justification for it. But we also have to recognize who benefits from it, right? And how that benefit is extracted. So I would stay focused on the systems. But, the, you know, if I had a final word here, I would say that, you know, in all of this, there's also kindness, right? We should be holding kindness in our hearts as a political value because we are going to need it in order to be able to get through the struggles ahead of us. You know, we are at the end of an era and many things are changing. And people are trying to find themselves in this messy situation we are in. They're going to turn to all kinds of things, including the Oppression Olympics. We could go easy on them and find a little kindness.
There's some words of true wisdom right there. Kindness, something so simple yet hard, seemingly difficult to attain these days. Well, you've been listening to Pacific Underground with our guest here, Scott Nakagawa from Change Lab. Thank you very much for joining us today, Scott.
We didn't even introduce ourselves.
Oh, yeah. Oh. I'm Jenny Yokoyama.
I'm Kanan Schlesinger.
And Tabitha was sitting in the room.
I don't think my mic is on. I think it is. Okay.
All the ideas were Tabitha's.
We'll be back next week from 9 to 10. We'll be talking about Asian and Pacific Islander Heritage Month and how awkward that is.
Look for us on Facebook. Yeah. At Pacific Underground, or look for us on SoundCloud too,
iTunes,
for previous episodes.
All the good stuff. Thanks for tuning in.
All right. Thanks a lot.